Hello, this is Jim Stein, your host for New Books in Mathematics. Our guest today is Oscar Fernandez, who's at Wellesley College and who has written a fascinating book entitled Everyday Calculus. As you might guess from the title, this book is largely a journey into daily life, showing where and how mathematics in general and calculus in particular shows up. Oscar, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot for having me, Jim.
It's a pleasure. You've written a very intriguing book, Oscar, but it is a book that does mathematics in addition to talking about mathematics. Whom do you see as the audience for the book?
Yeah, that's a great question, Jim. So the audience I envision is really split up into sort of two different categories. You know, I wrote the book with two readers in mind. The first one is really curious about math, maybe even calculus and its applications, but may not be too comfortable with equations, the actual math or calculus. The second group is probably a bit more comfortable with math, maybe somebody enrolled in a calculus course or somebody who took such a course sometime earlier in their life, but for whatever reason may have missed the applications of calculus and still kind of yearns for those days or is curious about what those are. That's the sort of a core group that I had in mind. But certainly, you know, I tried to write the book so that even if you've had no math experience at all, you could still read through the exposition of the book and not miss anything from not being able to do the math.
I'll say that that's really a good idea, because one of the things that I've found is that people enjoy reading about math, even if they don't have to do math, and maybe sometimes especially if they don't have to do math. But as I was reading your book, it occurred to me that this would be an absolutely wonderful book for someone to read after they've completed a first semester of calculus. Because when you take a first semester of calculus, most of the ideas that you discuss in the book that from a technical aspect are included in the first semester calculus. And normally a student who's taking the course doesn't really have the time to breathe. But after the first semester of calculus, when they've got a break between first and second semester, it's a great time to pick up your book. At least that's what I thought.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, I certainly had that group of readers in mind. And, you know, I taught calculus myself, and a lot of times, as a professor, and you know this as well, you are charged with teaching not only the material, but trying your best to give your students some sense of the applications. And this is one of the great things about writing a book, which is you can sort of steer the direction that you'd like to explore. And I really wanted this to be pretty much about the applications of calculus. I mean, sure, there needs to be some discussion of the math behind that. But that's why I also thought, you know, certain things that we can discuss, like how coffee cools, or how to sort of look up at the sky and see back in time. These are things that we can really explain without math. There's some intuition that we all have, and we can borrow that intuition to tell us about calculus. And that was really one of the main themes of the book.
I think that it would be a good idea to start off by telling people who haven't had much experience about what calculus is, because most people understand that geometry could be described as the study of shapes. Do you think you could give a relatively short description of calculus?
Sure. So, you know, the biggest thing that happens in calculus, from my perspective, is you start to study the way quantities change. So you might be interested, for example, in velocity, how fast a car is moving. You might be interested, if you're in business or finance, revenue or profit. You know, are you making money? Are you losing money? Or maybe you're a very physical sort of soul, and you're interested in how the planets move, or possibly, if you're in biology, maybe heart blood flow through the heart. So calculus is really a collection of ways to think about problems that involve some changing quantity. And one of the pillars of calculus, which is differentiation and derivatives, describe exactly that, how these quantities change. And the second half is really very related to this, and it involves more trying to add up lots of very small quantities. So this second pillar is called integration. So if you're interested, for example, in finding possibly how long, estimating a wait time, how long you're going to wait on a call if you're you're calling maybe your cell phone company. This turns out can be written as an integral problem. And there's a section in the book that I discussed this briefly in. So between integration and differentiation, those are the two basic pillars of calculus.
Yeah, that's basically how I describe it too when I teach the course. But now let's discuss a few specifics about your book. Early on, I was very intrigued by your explanation of the difference between DC and AC current and how Thomas Edison made one of his few horrible market decisions by failing to understand the impact that mathematics had on this question. And perhaps you could elaborate a little on this.
Yeah, this is actually a great story. So this is in, I believe, the first chapter of the book, relatively early on. So, Edison, being a genius inventor, had one major feature he could not have foreseen, I describe in the book, which is that he based his whole power system on direct current. And direct current is, easy to understand if you think about the batteries, say, in your phone or in your digital camera. So those have a fixed voltage. You know, we're used to thinking about maybe 9-volt batteries. And voltage is kind of the amount of electrical energy that the battery has. And Edison's plants turned out operated on a voltage that was fixed. So I believe it was about 110 volts. So this is a fixed number. It didn't change. But it turns out, as I say in the first chapter, that the wires that are needed to transmit the electricity coming from these plants, they have a certain radius. And when you have a voltage of 110 volts, the radius for these wires is relatively big. And when you need to string really long wires to maybe get electricity to your house 10 miles down the road, turns out that this radius has to be even bigger. And this is one of these rational functions that I talk about in the first chapter of the book. So poor Edison ended up having to have power plants about every 2 miles from each other. So, in one sense, you might think, oh, this is great because I can just, build lots of power plants, lots of demand. But, at that time, this is a relatively new energy system, transmission system. There were a lot of startup costs and the economies of scale just weren't there. So if you switch the lid a little bit and you take a look at this function, it turns out that if you can allow for higher voltages, the radius of your power line gets smaller. And simultaneously, you can string longer power lines. So this is pretty much the downfall, I write, of Edison's DC current in a way. A little bit later on, alternating current came along, which allowed you to change the voltage, in particular to make it much higher. And this is why we have transformers, which I describe in the book. You can see all around you when you walk outside. And these transformers take the really high voltages from the power plants and step them down to something that, is 110 or 220, depending on what country you live, so that our appliances can work. So with a really high voltage, you get a really small power line radius, and there's no danger that you'll walk under a power line and the thing will fall on you because it's so heavy. So poor Edison, despite the fact that he was a genius inventor, neglecting a little bit of the rational function that was lurking around there, eventually spelled doom for his DC empire. And I think it's a wonderful story.
Yeah, I thought it was a wonderful story as well, and I never heard it, and I thought it was great. And when you speak of rational functions, rational functions mean things that are basically the quotients of polynomials, but you also discuss a couple of other types of functions that underlie calculus, namely trigonometric and logarithmic functions. But my understanding is that when calculus was originally discovered or invented by Newton, Bernoulli, and all the other people who were looking at it at the time, I think that the function concept had not been explicitly enunciated. And it's sort of curious that they could develop all of calculus without having this incredible tool of functions available for them to work with.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. And this is, math history is such such a interesting subject. And as you say, back in the day when calculus was being developed, there wasn't even a clear notion of what a function was. You know, if you go back to Euler and some of his writings, one of his best definitions for a function is an equation involving some variables and some constants, basically. This is a big paraphrasing, but it is nowhere near sort of the formalism that we have today. And one of the interesting things is that this pops up also in the book when I discuss the integral. So the integral that we use and we teach today as part of calculus is really due to Riemann, who actually, wasn't even alive until the 1800s, way after Newton and Leibniz first started thinking about calculus in the 1600s. So the way we teach calculus today is really a sort of an amalgamation of events that are not at all chronological. And part of that is that, you know, as we've gotten more sophisticated with the math and understood a bit better how to make these things rigorous, we've incorporated that into the curriculum so that now we have a nice sort of pretty much linear sequence of topics we teach students. But in terms of the history, it is fascinating. I often tell my students, I'm teaching a course right now, for example, on Fourier analysis, and it's named after a Fourier who tried at some point to write functions in terms of sines and cosines. And he showed that it could be done, but I tell my students that a lot of times what a lot of famous mathematicians would do is they would do what are called formal calculations. So they would expand a function in terms of sines and cosines, but not provide any justification for why it's possible. Or in Newton's case, they would, you know, find the derivative of a function, but not really tell you exactly what the derivative means. But, you know, so it usually takes somebody down the road, maybe hundreds of years later, to come in and formalize and make rigorous what all these things are. And the function concept is exactly one of those things.
I think that's very interesting because one of the things that happens with virtually all breakthrough theories, and at the time that calculus was developed, it was certainly a breakthrough theory, that you say something like only 12 men in the world can understand it. And that's what they said about Einstein's theory of relativity. But after a while, people start looking at it. They refine the presentation. They simplify the ideas. And now calculus, which was understood by only a few people, is now routinely taught to maybe millions or even tens of millions of people throughout the world every year. So that's pretty interesting. And it's also a tribute to the value of teachers and the value of not necessarily always discovering new things, but presenting old things better.
Yeah. And if I could just say one more thing there, this reminds me of a quick conversation I had with a student a few days ago. She's, in her first year, and she's interested in possibly exploring math as a major. And she asked me, I can't even think about what you would do in terms of research for math. Like, if you're a chemist, I understand that you have a chemistry lab and I can sort of picture what you do, but how does a mathematician do research? And one of the first responses I had for her was that, she's in a calculus one class. And I said, well, all of the calculus you're learning was math research at some point in the past. And it's exactly this idea that at some point, this was cutting edge stuff and nobody really knew exactly what it all meant. And it literally took a few hundred years for us to figure it all out. But we figured it out to a point now that we can teach it at a high school level, at a first year university level.
I had almost the identical question asked last night when I was teaching a course in third semester calculus. A student asked me, how long is the interval between discovery and application? And I said, I'm sure that we'd each look at this probably pretty much the same. Some math is produced because it has a specific need. Like, I think Newton invented calculus to study mechanics and gravitation. And then there was Einstein, who used differential geometry about 30 years after it was discovered. And some math I don't think will ever be applied.
Yeah, I'm pretty much of the same mindset. I always hold that hope that, even for the pure mathematicians that are not necessarily motivated by applications, that even sometime in their future, some of it will be used. But certainly it's a, incredible to see sometimes how things you might not have thought to have any application end up showing up in the most remote places.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I must admit, that's one of the joys of mathematics. Getting back to your book, what made you decide to introduce rates of change through stock prices rather than the more conventional approach that uses average and instantaneous velocities?
So when I was formulating the book and the plot structure, just because of the way things worked out, one of the real features of the book that I tried very hard to stick to was I wanted to write each chapter so that the math contained in that chapter would match the math you would learn in the corresponding chapter of a calculus book. So, for example, the first chapter in my book discusses only functions. There are no derivatives. There are no integrals. If you open up the first chapter of a typical calculus book, that's all you'll find, only functions. So in the second chapter is when I start talking a little bit about derivatives. But in terms of the plot story, I'm still sort of waking up and maybe getting dressed. So the usual way to introduce derivatives by looking at, let's say, the velocity of a car or a falling object, I thought would have done the job, but I wanted to really drive home the point, which I say throughout the book and also in the epilogue, that derivatives really describe change. And I started thinking to myself, what's something in the morning ritual of most of us that we do that, you know, encompasses lots of change? And the first thing that came to my mind was just the economy. You know, there's interest rates are always changing. Stock prices are changing. There's unemployment rate changing. There's so much change in the economy. And I thought, oh, this is great. So I will try to use this to introduce the concept of a derivative.
One of the things that I liked about your book, which you sort of alluded to a moment ago when you were talking, was that you sort of have a continual theme throughout the book. You're going through what might very well be described as a typical day, although I suspect that what happened was there were a lot of anecdotes and incidents that got plastered together that took place throughout your life. But it was nice because what you're doing is you're going through a typical day, things are happening to you, and you're examining these things the way that mathematicians think about these things. And of course, that's not the type of thing that's done in a calculus book, but this isn't a calculus book. It's a book about calculus and about life, and I like that approach.
Yeah, and you know, I think this goes back to one of my main motivations for writing the book in this way. You know, it's really goes back to, I think, the feelings a lot of us have with math. So my mother, for example, says that she has vivid recollections of sort of her, quote, math wall. You know, when she got to algebra and she was asked to solve 2x plus 3 equals 7, she couldn't do it. She to this day says, I just don't understand, you know, a variable x. You know, it's not something that clicks for me. So I think, you know, the majority of us have a sort of our own math wall, some point that we hit where we say, you know what, this is too hard. This subject is not for me. So that was part of my motivation for the book. I wanted to say, well, there are all these things that happen around you, all of these everyday things that a lot of times we don't think too much about, like the cooling of coffee or the GPS that we use from our phone. But in reality, if you stop to think about it and really ask a few very critical questions, you'll discover that the math is just right there in plain sight. It just requires a bit more tinkering and a bit more playing, as if you were sort of back in your childhood and just in a sandbox with a bunch of toys. So I really wanted to encompass that in the book and really give readers a way to approach math from what they already know, their intuition about the world.
Well, I think you mentioned the cooling of coffee, and I like that application because Newton's law of cooling is what you use to bring in exponential functions. And this is an everyday application, and normally in a calculus text, or indeed in a pre-calculus text, or any time they talk about exponential functions, they start talking about either radioactive decay or unencumbered growth rates. But most of us encounter a lot more coffee than than radioactive materials.
Exactly. And this is related to the earlier point of why choose stock prices to introduce the derivatives. And that's the same idea there. I wanted to really make sure that as much as possible, the examples that I use were things that really are every day. Coffee cooling down, you turn on the TV and you see a graph of a stock chart. So definitely, yeah, I'm not one that encounters radioactive materials myself.
Well, I could relate an incident where when I was I made a mistake of volunteering for a medical experiment when I was young. I didn't know exactly what it was, but they pumped an armful of radioactive material into my blood and then withdrew it every other day for 2 months. And I learned something very important. Never volunteer. They tell you that in the Army. But anyway, another topic that's often extremely difficult for students to understand is that of discontinuous functions. And I like the way that you introduced it by talking about multivitamins. And it impressed me that also what you discussed applies to other drugs such as insulin for diabetics.
Yeah, exactly. So the idea here is that, what is a continuous function? So I give a very verbal definition of this. So if you, take a pencil, you just draw a curve with your hand, never lifting up your hand from the paper, then what you've drawn is a continuous function. So in English, the word is pretty much the same as what the math meaning is. A discontinuous function, then you would sort of draw a curve and then you would stop somewhere and pick up your hand and put it somewhere else on the paper and finish drawing the curve. So there's maybe a gap between the curves you drew. There are other types of discontinuous functions. But really, one way to think about this physically is, you wake up in the morning, and if you're the person, that sort of person that takes vitamins, then before you take your vitamin, there is a zero vitamin in you. So, you certainly have some vitamin B6 and B12 floating around from, the normal processes of your body. But once you take your vitamin, all of a sudden, discontinuously, as soon as that begins to get digested, you are increasing the amount of vitamins in your body. And I thought this was a way to make this particular concept of a discontinuous function very real. And as you say, if you replace vitamin by maybe an insulin dose or any other sort of injection of something, maybe the radioactive material, then you would have this same sort of discontinuity effect. And in the book, I believe this is in chapter 2, there's a quick graph to show you sort of what you would expect, which is after you eat the vitamin, it gets digested, but eventually those vitamins are used up by your body. So you can draw a little curve to show you that as you, go forward, the amount of vitamin in your body is dropping as it's being digested. And the day restarts, and what do you do the next day? You take another vitamin.
Yeah, it's there's a branch of mathematics called fixed point theory, in which I did some work, which also the same phenomenon is encountered. What you do is you find the dosage to give someone that maintains the insulin in their body or the vitamins or whatever you want at essentially the same level to, in order to maintain maintain a stable, healthy existence. Anyway, there were, you talked about the changing unemployment rate, and I don't know whether or not you have anything in particular to say about this, but there was Richard Nixon was a seminal figure in the lives of people of my age. And during the campaign for re-election in 1972, he said that the rate of inflation was decreasing. And a mathematician said, this is the first time that a sitting president used the third derivative to advance his case for re-election.
Yeah, I think it's funny, but at the same time, it's it reminds me of when when people make a statement such as a derivative it was on the tip of my tongue, so I'll remember it. But what I was going to say is that it's one of those examples where all of us maybe colloquially are using some mathematical language that may not exactly translate to the average person to be mathematical. And this is exactly it. So the rate of inflation was decreasing. That's, inflation is measured relative to some prior level. So that's a rate. And then there's another rate that is decreasing. So you do get this, indeed get this third derivative. But in this context, in the book, I believe this is chapter three, I do talk about unemployment because it is one of these things that you hear on the radio or on TV, part of the economy. And, both political parties will say things about unemployment all the time. They'll say the unemployment rate was decreasing. The unemployment rate was increasing. And, in calculus speak, that's really telling you information about the second derivative of the unemployment function. And it's a really great way to just pick out these things from the airways and say, wait a minute, this is, there's a little math behind this. It's not just about the economy. There really is some unemployment function. And these pieces of information are telling me about the curvature of that function, which is one of the things we discuss in that chapter of the book of how the second derivative relates to the curvature of the function.
There's another idea that also relates to the idea that linear functions, straight lines, supply very good approximations to rates of change. And you used a beautiful example of this, which I think sort of brings advanced physics and mathematics and everyday life together. When you talk about how Einstein's theory of relativity plays an important role in the GPS system and how this idea of linearization that comes from calculus enables us to do the computations easily that show us how critical Einstein's theory is to maintaining our GPS system to work accurately.
Yeah, so actually that's another beautiful story. And before I talk about that, I just remembered. So I was trying to find the statement that I hear made sometimes. So the statement is, the object was traveling at a high rate of speed. So sometimes people use this to refer to just, a high speed. But really, if you take the rate of a speed, you're talking about the acceleration. So this is another one of those instances where, the words rate and what you take the rate of actually tells you a bit about taking a derivative of something. This GPS story is absolutely fascinating. In the book, I set it up by saying, I am sort of traveling down a road and, I'm driving to work basically. And a lot of us have run into this problem where you hit traffic. So then you, pull out your phone or maybe your GPS unit and you try to find an alternate route. And a lot of times when you do that, especially in my case, with Google, it'll take me through some place I've never driven through before. So I like to have this thing on to just guide me through, and it tells me where to turn and how long I have to take to get to work. The thing is that really relies on the assumption that the GPS is accurate. So if this is off even by half a mile, then I may be turning on the wrong street and I may never get to work. And the funny thing is that these GPS systems all work by bouncing signals off GPS satellites, which are in orbit around the Earth. And anytime you transmit anything over a very large distance, and the ground to a satellite in orbit is reasonably large, it takes a finite amount of time for that to happen, even if it's something traveling at the speed of light, like the signal from your cell phones are, or your GPS unit. So what I do in the book is I walk through a really interesting finding from Einstein called time dilation. So Einstein found in about 1905 that moving clocks are slow. So if you were to jump on a spaceship and take a trip to Mars, by the time you get back to Earth, you might have aged 1 hour, but the entire world would have aged maybe 2 hours. So this is really groundbreaking at the time, you can imagine. It was sort of earth-shattering to think that time was somehow relative. And this is exactly why Einstein has his theory of relativity. And this actually happens with GPSs. So the GPS satellites in orbit are traveling at some velocity orbiting the planet. And we here on Earth are traveling at a much lower velocity relative to the center of the planet. So there really is this effect going on. It turns out I calculated in the book that 1 second on a GPS satellite is about 1.1 maybe 5 or 6, 7 zeros and then 839 seconds to us. So in other words, there's a little fraction, tiny fraction of a difference between how time is measured with the GPS satellite, on the GPS satellite, and how time is measured on the clocks in our GPS unit in the car. And linearization comes in because we say, well, if you're an engineer and you want the GPS system to work, you need to account for this discrepancy. And one of the ways you could do that is with some basic calculus, specifically this idea of linearization.
That's extremely interesting. And when you talk about equations, because one of the things that I firmly believe is I believe that equations are the language of the universe. And what always surprises me is how there's sometimes the same equation appears in several apparently unrelated environments. And you bring this up when you discuss the logistic equation, because you discuss it both in the area of productivity and also in the area of sustainability. And maybe you could describe how these two phenomena are linked by one equation.
Yeah, I totally agree, by the way, that one equation might represent so many different things. And that's actually one of the beautiful things about math. In regards to productivity and logistic equations specifically, I think this might be in chapter 4 of the book where the logistic equation first pops up. The scenario that I introduce is that, you know, maybe you're at a conference, you're at a meeting, you're in a classroom, and somebody in the classroom is sick. So you're not sure who it is, but there's certainly with any contagious infection, let's say maybe it's a cold, contagious disease, there might be a certain rate of infection. You know? So there's a certain likelihood that you might contract the illness. And it turns out if you do some very simple math, you can come up with an equation for this that is called the logistic equation. And it has a graph for the number of infected individuals that kind of looks like an S. So initially, you know, the infection spreads, and then it reaches a sort of point where it's spreading the fastest. And then assuming you are enclosed in this room and nobody leaves, then of course everyone would get infected eventually. So that explains sort of the S shape. The interesting thing though is that this S shape appears all over the place in other places. So if you've ever looked at the graph of a population of a particular country or the world for that matter, it has much the same shape. So the population rises seemingly exponentially at first, but then sort of the curse of finite resources and maybe disease and pollution take over and slows down that increase. And then eventually, because we're in a finite planet, we know that population growth has to stall. So this is another example of this logistic equation showing up not only in the spread of infectious diseases, but also in the growth rate of population. And I'll throw in one more, which is you can imagine these viral videos on YouTube. So how do these get started? Well, somebody makes a video that is very popular, only has a few followers at first, but then it gains traction. So all of a sudden we have maybe a sort of exponential increase in viewership. And then maybe it reaches a high point where it's featured on some news channel. And then after that, it's had its sort of 15 minutes of fame. So viewership starts to drop off. So you again get this sort of S-shaped curve. And actually, the logistic equation is a model for all of these three phenomena and so many more, especially in sustainability, which is where I talk about it in the chapter with relation to sustainable fisheries.
Yeah, that was extremely interesting. And I remember the first place that I was introduced to the logistic equation was in the spread of a rumor. And right. It's sort of like the spread of an infectious disease. I guess you can think of a rumor as being an infectious disease. But one of the things I think that we both share about the philosophy of mathematics is that it not only tells you quantitatively what's happening if you solve the equations, but it also tells you qualitatively what it it has, because most of us go through life, we say things like we're going fast rather than we're going 65.3 miles per hour. And if you look at mathematics, and this is one of the things in, that you do in the book, you describe certain phenomena qualitatively rather than exactly and quantitatively. And I think that that's very useful.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that's where the structure of the book lends itself to that connection. So we all have our intuition with things like the cooling of coffee. And if you know that coffee is cooling, well, what are we talking about? We're talking about the temperature of the coffee. So cooling means that the temperature is getting lower. So now you're talking about a decreasing function. So that's a qualitative description, but you've taken a few steps now to making it quantitative, you know. So maybe you can draw an example of the function for the temperature of the coffee, and I think that I really try to utilize that sort of, you know, reverse engineering, so to speak, to help the reader use their daily experiences with daily intuition to sort of discover the actual calculus behind these things.
I think that's an extremely good teaching tool as well, and it's one that should be incorporated in math education as soon as kids start taking mathematics, because you want them to get the idea that mathematics is not something we study between 2 and 3 p.m. Mathematics is something that we look at as a way to understand what's happening to us and as a way to improve our lives. And when you start looking at things through the lens of mathematics, I think not only does the clarity of your focus improve, but it also makes you realize how all these things are sort of linked together. Sometimes the same equation, like a logistic equation, describes a number of things. But the more sophisticated that you are in describing things mathematically, I think the more you appreciate the world.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And, you know, the one of the chapters in the book is called Connected by Calculus. And it's exactly that idea that one equation, one concept in math may connect a variety of different phenomena together. The other thing I'll say to piggyback off that comment is that when you succeed in casting a problem in mathematical form, you really open up a huge array of possibilities, because once you sort of mathematize a problem, this is what I call it in the book, you are at liberty to use all of the results known in math. So if you can write an equation for your phenomenon, maybe you can, I don't know, take the derivative, or maybe you can find the roots of the equation. And in other words, you can draw conclusions from the model that you have created. And sometimes these conclusions can be predictive. So just by formalizing the problem in math, you may be able to not only gain more insight, but actually make predictions, you know, outputs that you didn't foresee when you first started doing the mathematical modeling.
I think that's absolutely right. And you brought it up when you were discussing Einstein's theory of relativity, because I'm absolutely certain that even though there's this, you know, there's this legendary example that Einstein gave, is he imagined himself riding on a beam of light away from a clock. And if he were on the beam of light, he'd never see the clock change, so that it would be sort of like the photograph that was taken of the clock at the instant that the beam of light originated. And he realized that if you travel at the speed of light, maybe time doesn't change, but I'm sure when the time dilation equation and the other equations of relativity, like the length contraction and the one that mass gets heavier as you travel closer to the speed of light, I'm sure when he saw those, he said, wow, I just never expected this.
Exactly. And, you know, I'll say for the benefit of the readers, these things are so strange to get their heads around, get your head around. But, you know, you might first think that this is just not true. You know, there's something off. You know, the calculations are wrong, or there's some assumptions made that are not true. But one of the good things about physics is that it's an experimental science. So, you know, one of the easy ways to verify this, for example, time dilation effect, is put a clock on a plane and have that plane fly around the world. And before you have the plane take off, you synchronize the clock with one on the ground. Fly the plane around the world, and then when the plane lands, compare the two clocks. And this has actually been done. And it turns out that, sure enough, the exact discrepancy from time dilation shows up. And you know, it's so these concepts are as crazy as they seem, really come from actually a pretty simple analysis in the time dilation context. We can derive that equation with actually no more than algebra. But as you say, once Einstein saw these things, it was a complete turn of events for the field of physics. Now there's modern day physics is divided into non-relativistic physics, where your speeds are slow enough compared to the speed of light that these effects are not felt, and relativistic physics, where you're maybe moving close to the speed of light. This is, for example, the things that physicists who use particle accelerators have to be concerned about, because some of those particles really do move very close to the speed of light.
Oscar, one of the things that I enjoyed about your book is that for most people who teach calculus, we sort of slog through the mechanics of actually finding derivatives so that we can get to problems such as optimization problems, which tell you the best way to do things. And you introduced this through the problem of where should you sit in a theater in order to get the best view. But there are also other problems worth discussing. Maybe you could say something about this and some other problems that appeal to you in this area.
Sure. Yeah. So the main appearance of optimization in the book, I believe, is in chapter 5. And I really wanted to do this. Keep going on this. Use our intuition to tell us about the math idea. And the way I introduce optimization is by thinking about just throwing a pair. And this is another one of these strange things that is true when you stop and think about it. But if you throw a cup in the air, eventually it falls to the ground. That's we're familiar with that. That's gravity. But that means that at some point, it was moving upward, and then afterwards it was moving downward. So at some point, there must have been a point where the upward velocity was zero, which is really strange, because you say this to a student, you say, well, the cup was stationary at some point, and in the vertical direction. That seems a little weird, but once you think about this trajectory in your mind, it's actually the highest vertical position of the cup. So there's a really nice link between if I graph a function and I see that it turns around somewhere, and also thinking about the maximum value of that function. And you could totally express this as saying that the function is pretty much flat at this little maximum value. And that's precisely what it means to have a zero derivative. So there's the calculus. So in the book, I use that motivation to talk about optimization problems where you want to maximize or minimize a certain quantity that we may not, think about, but that are actually happening every day around us. So one of the ones is the one you described, where you walk into a theater and you may be interested to figure out what's the best place that I can sit. And I run through a sort of model of that in the book, where you're interested in getting the best viewing angle of the screen. If you sit too close to the screen, then your sort of neck is twisted for the entire movie. If you sit too far away, then the screen looks maybe like 5 inches big or something. So there's a sort of optimum row to sit in to get that viewing angle. But I just want to mention two or three other ones. The blood vessel branching problem, I thought, is a really neat application of this. So, if you're the human body and you're thinking about blood flow and trying to minimize, let's say, the resistance to blood flow, then you might want to focus on branching bigger arteries to smaller ones at certain angles. And it turns out that there are some angles that minimize this resistance. And this is the discussion in chapter 5. And, another good example is if you're a company, let's say, or if you start your own business, you might be interested in maximizing your profit. So, you sell some product and that generates revenue, but it costs you a certain amount of money to make your product. So that's a cost. So your profit is your revenue minus your cost. And then you have some sort of function that maybe you can optimize. Maybe, for your particular company, selling 100 units is the maximum profit versus selling 50 or 125. So I think those are all great examples of optimization, and there's so many more. That's this is one of the few topics in the book that I keep coming back to throughout the book.
Well, the one that I always liked when I was teaching calculus is an economic problem, because I teach a lot of calculus for business students, and students always say, where am I going to use this? And I ask them to imagine a can of soup, and most cans of soup have something like 16 ounces. And I ask them, have you ever wondered why the cans are shaped the way they are and not flat like a pizza or long and thin like a strand of spaghetti?
Yeah.
And they think about that. And there's really an optimal way to design a soup can in such a way that it contains a minima of the amount of soup that you want and cost the least. And I said, imagine that you're Campbell's Soup and that you manufacture 10 billion cans of soup a year, which is, I think, what they do. If you're off by a penny on the cost, that's $100 million off of your bottom line on 10 billion cans of soup. So you gotta get these problems right.
Exactly. And, you know, this feeds in nicely to, there's a discussion in the book that I have of trying to minimize the amount of fuel that takes for me to drive from work to home. So, you know, if, for example, in my case in the book, I calculate that I save maybe, I don't know, two-tenths of a gallon of gas, you know, which is not that much. I don't know, $4 a gallon, right? That's not a lot of money. But I say in there, let's say you're a company like FedEx or UPS, and you have trucks, you know, thousands of trucks that drive, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of miles every year. If you can save each truck, you know, a fraction of a dollar, that indeed adds up to a lot of savings throughout the whole company. So, you know, companies like FedEx, UPS, American Airlines, they really have teams of people who are just dedicated to optimizing their profit streams. And, you know, there's one subset of engineering called operations research, which is dedicated just to exactly this, to try to optimize things like profits, revenue, minimize costs. So it's one of the real easy places to see calculus sort of at work behind the scenes.
Oscar, I've really enjoyed this talk, and you end the book with a couple of the deeper applications of calculus, Einstein's theory of relativity, and also the problem of determining the evolution and fate of the universe. These are problems in astronomy and physics, but do you think that as science progresses, we are going to find other deep applications of calculus in fields such as the life and the social sciences?
Yeah, I definitely think so. I think you know, currently mathematical biology is one of the sort of hot fields that is in some sense a very old field, but I think now with all the progress we've made on the supercomputing fronts, it is very easy to model very complicated systems like the human heart or an organ, for example, mathematically, and then try to determine some predictions from this, like we were talking about earlier. So the interesting thing is that at the very core, and this is one of the messages of the book, calculus describes change. So that's what sort of derivatives do. And then integrals and calculus, when you combine them, which is what I refer to as the dream team, they really can have very powerful insights, such as telling you about the age of the universe and the fate of the universe. So, you know, when you start looking at very complicated problems, for example, trying to understand how the brain works or trying to model the human heart, I have absolutely no doubt that at some point in the mathematical analysis of this, you will definitely end up using some version of calculus, whether a derivative, whether an integral, or some combination, this sort of dream team.
Yeah, I've always felt that when I took calculus, I felt that calculus marked the difference between old ways of thinking and new ways of thinking. And I've always felt that if you go to a university, you cannot really consider yourself to be educated unless you take a course in calculus.
I think it really is one of those subjects where, you know, it as you say, it's, you know, just historically appeared in the 1600s was really when calculus started. Really, there were remnants of it all the way back to Archimedes, but 1600s is really when it started taking off, and it was a really big departure. And if you are able to study calculus, which I definitely encourage everyone to do, and I hope that this book is at least a doorway into doing so. Calculus itself opens all these doors for you. So a very good follow-up would be maybe a course in differential equations, and then you could maybe understand some of these ideas of how to model the human heart, blood flow in the heart, or population growth, things of this nature. And really anything else that you study in math, at some point you can use what you learned in calculus to at least give you a little bit of insights. So it's a really great course that I think I agree everyone should have under their belts.
I absolutely agree with you, and we've discussed the book, but let's end with a discussion of Oscar Fernandez. Do you have any future projects in mind?
Oh, sure. So my focus now is on thinking a bit about the context of this book and readers who might be interested in either a follow-up or maybe a prequel of sorts. So those are two sort of projects on the horizon that I have interest in. So a natural follow-up to this book focused primarily on a Calculus I course. So traditionally at the university level, we teach three semesters, or if you're in a different system, you might only teach two semesters, but three subdivisions of calculus. So the second one is also, all three are fascinating, but Calculus II tends to be a bit more obscured by things like infinite series and infinite sums, but they're fascinating stories there just all the same. And Calculus III really starts doing things in three dimensions. So you talk about curves in three dimensions, and you talk about things that are somewhat physically like physics-y, like electric fields, magnetic fields, and how you integrate over surfaces in three dimensions. So that's one of the sort of projects that's on my horizon. I'd be very interested in doing that. And the prequel version is, the appendix, first appendix in the book, I try to give the reader a quick sort of refresher on precalculus. So describing functions and graphs. And I think it's as much as I could have done for this book, but I'm certainly interested in doing a sort of everyday precalculus idea where we discuss some of these ideas from geometry and algebra in much the same way to bring together the intuition you might have from things like triangles or squares and talk about functions like quadratics and how you see those in the real world. So those are certainly a few projects that I'm interested in doing in the future.
Oscar, I wish you the best of luck with them, and thanks for participating this afternoon. Take care.
Thanks for having me.